We have two storage trunks at home in our garage that are, the trunks themselves are rather inexpensive. They're just fiberboard trunks you get like at Kmart. But in each of those trunks are very important things. They're the keepsakes that Michelle has set aside for Megan and Derek from their childhood as they've grown up, and certain things that she wanted to save for them. And in Megan's trunk is a small pink and gray dress that she wore when she was 1 year old. And we have a picture of her in that dress, all tidied up. And what makes it so special is it's the same dress that Michelle wore when she was 1 year old. And she had saved this dress and passed it on. And she has a picture. We have a picture now of Michelle at one and Megan at one. And, you know, we think, well, is it possible someday there could be a third picture? Save that dress and pass it on, and here'll be another little girl at 1 year old, and you'll have three generations all tied together by that one thing. Having continuity in our lives is important to us. It gives us security, encourages stability and structure in our lives, but it's not something that many of us really get to have, not in its fullest sense. We had a maple tree planted in our yard this past summer. I was down at one of the nurseries in the valley, and I saw this maple tree out in the corner of the nursery, and it had just come in, and they stuck it out there next to some other trees, and it was the only one like it, and we wanted to have a tree in the backyard, and so I asked and confirmed that it was available for us, and it was, and so I just told them we would take it, and I went home and told Michelle what I had done, that there was a maple tree coming. That she says, well, how much was it? I says, I don't know. She says, what? I said, I don't know. She said, well, you know, give me an estimate. I said, well, you know, I don't know. I said, it was the only one they had. I took it. It was about 20 feet tall, maybe a little bigger than that, nice crown on it, good thick trunk to it. And I wanted a tree that I would see actually in this life. And so as we waited for this to be delivered and the bill and everything to come, we kind of began to estimate, and of course her concerns elevated my concerns, and then I would elevate hers, and so we kind of bid each other up on this tree. And by the time we finally got that cleared, we were quite relieved, because we had probably doubled its price in our minds and estimating what this must have been. But it was astounding to her that I would actually just say, yes, I want it, and then walk out the door and not really have put that in its perspective. The reason I did that is we've never really lived anywhere long enough to watch a tree grow, and I wanted to see one that I could put to use the way God intended, maybe in that sense, a tree to be. We lived in Lubbock for 6 years before we came to this area and live now in Spokane, and for me that was a long time. In fact, that's the longest time I've ever lived in one house in my life, the 6 years that we were there in Lubbock, Texas. I've lived in 12 different states where I actually had a place that I lived. In one of those states, I lived in three different cities, and in one of those cities, I lived in seven different homes. Now, all of us would run the numbers differently. Many of you have traveled in different ways, lived in different places. There are different things in your life, or the same things in your life, that have not contributed in some ways to that kind of stability and that kind of continuity that we would all desire. Our son Brad attended 11 different grade schools, and two of the schools he went to twice. He's had as many dads as we've had assignments in the field ministry, and because I wasn't there to contribute to that stability in his life. And so it kind of perpetuates itself if we don't stop and be as responsible as we can for those things that God gives us. All of life, and even this flesh, is a sojourn. It's a temporary dwelling. It's like taking a little handful of dust and throwing it up in the air. You know, if you pick up a big, hearty handful of dust, it will make a big, thick cloud, and momentarily it will seem to be quite impressive. But in a very short time, the dust will settle, the air will clear, and it's gone, and it won't even be like it was ever there. Our life is very much like that, like a cloud of dust that dissipates in a moment. A very temporary, momentary thing. In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, there's a passage here that gives reflection on our life. And You know, Ecclesiastes could be a rather sobering book. In fact, it is to me rather sobering. And it does in the end point us to this life without God is of most desperate plight. But Ecclesiastes 1, verse number 12 says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This grievous task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. And I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Grasping for a handful of air is portrayed biblically to this life, like throwing up that dust and watching it blow away, and then it is gone. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart and said, look, I have attained greatness, and I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. In this life I succeeded above the rest. I accomplished more, I produced. My knowledge has understood great wisdom and knowledge, my heart, excuse me, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceive that this also is a grasping for the wind. In and of itself, apart from God, without purpose in our lives, it's like grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. At home, we have some other pictures. A couple of those pictures we just received about 2 years ago from a relative, pictures that I had not seen before, but there's a picture of me on a little rocking horse, a little white rocking horse with blue and red trim, fiberboard molded rocking horse. I don't know if anyone remembers some of those from your own childhood. My mother said I used to sit on that rocking horse, and I remember the horse. The picture was when I was two. I don't remember that time in my life, but she said I used to sit on the horse and rock until I fell asleep. I would just sit there. It was so secure to me to rock back and forth and lean over the front of that horse and eventually just simply go to sleep in place. It was one of my greatest treasures as a child, and as I grew older, though, my perspective changed, my values slowly changed. The horse was set aside and eventually given away. Life went on, and there were other toys that became my favorites. There was the stuffed golden monkey that was basically almost wore out from hugging it and holding it and throwing it around that I had when I had whooping cough. And I remember the monkey just as clearly as I remember the disease. It was a time in my life when that was very important to me. You know, it's a funny thing. The horse is gone, the monkey's gone. But after all these years, I'd like them back. I'd like to take that horse and that monkey and put them in my office somewhere next to the Lionel train that did survive, the 40-year-old train set that is now in my bookshelf that I look at, and the kids beg for me to take down so that they can play with it too. Someday I'll take it down and I'll hook it up and I'll put the transformer on and I'll run it around in a circle and let them see that and return it to the shelf. I wish there were a few more things that I once treasured that I could have held on to, at least just for perspective, to remind me of what once was. Another picture that we received about 2 years ago was of my mom and my dad back in 1953. Now, my mom died when I was a year old, so this is the mother that raised me. It's my stepmother, the only mother that I knew. My mom and dad were younger then than Michelle and I are now, and they looked strong and vibrant and handsome and beautiful. It's amazing for me to look back, and there's my dad and my mom next to a bicycle on a bridge. And it just seemed an incredible thing, again, younger than we are now. But all that changes. And before my dad died, he couldn't even get up or rise out of his bed, and nor feed himself. And in fact, he died in bed with my mom feeding him breakfast. She gave him something to drink and went to the kitchen and came back, and he was dead. This flesh is often just a striving after the wind. And what is so very, very important to us is quickly muted by the passage of just a few short years. And that's important to understand, and it bears an impact on what we are doing here today. You might not find out for a few more verses what that impact is, but that's a style that keeps you in suspense. And hopefully I won't leave as many questions as Glenn did to be answered later. First Chronicles 29 refers to this life in all of its great glory, as, at least as we would like to see it sometimes. 1 Chronicles 29, verse number 10, David had collected the offerings for the temple to build to God, for God, and to worship him with. And in verse 10 it says, "Therefore David blessed the Lord before all the congregation, and said, 'Blessed are you, O Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever.'" He begins to focus on how great God is. And when you do that, it's amazing how that starts to bring back into perspective how simple and how weak and frame we are. "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power and the glory, the victory, the majesty, for all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord. You're exalted as head over all. Both riches and honor come from you, and you reign over all. In your hand is power and might, and your hand is it there to make great, to give strength to all. Now, therefore, our God, we thank you and praise in your glorious name. But who am I, and who are my people, that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? What little thing is it that we would even be able to give back to you something that is already yours? How insignificant that is. How incredible by perspective. All things come from you, and of your own we have given you. We are aliens," he said. Aliens. It's like we really don't even have a place that we are rooted that we can call our own. We're just passing through. We are strangers, pilgrims before you, as were all of our fathers. Our days on earth are as a shadow. As the sun goes over that maple tree and casts a shadow, and when it moves, the shadow is gone, and there's no evidence that it was even there. Our days on earth are like a shadow and without hope, obviously, apart from God. Over the last few weeks, basically since the meteor shower sometime back, there was a meteor shower, and kids wanted to see it, and Megan went out specifically to watch and see the meteors, and we were counting some coming in. And you know, I was fascinated to be reintroduced in that sense to the night sky, because life's busy and you go on, and I work inside at night in my office, and I haven't been really focused on it. So over the last few weeks, the last thing I do as I can is go out and sit out on the patio, and everybody's in bed and it's quiet and the lights are out, and I just look up at the stars and I begin to imagine what God created, and I begin to try to focus on how incredible his creation is. And by contrast, I'm reminded of how little and insignificant we are. When I lived in New Mexico on a ranch, I was so far out into the desert that you could literally see those stars in brilliance and magnitude. You could see the edge of the Milky Way cut right through the top of the sky. You could see that band of that disk of stars up there. And I searched for that on my patio, and it's a little brighter here, and I can kind of make out where it runs. It's an amazing thing. We are just a little passage of breeze that momentarily touches the cheek and is gone, and you can't hardly remember that it was there. And yet we exalt ourselves, and we strive to build great things, and we want to be recognized for what it is that we have done and accomplished. And if we could even imagine God looking back down on us from where he is and see how insignificant we are, we would be stunned. I think David reflected on that. Psalm 8 is a passage that I imagine if David had a patio, he sat out on it, or frankly, he probably camped so many nights out there in the desert himself and looked up at those stars that he pondered those things. Psalm 8, "O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, you who set your glory above the heavens." Greater and more glorious than anything God created is he himself. "Out of the mouth of babes and infants you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger." God takes people who are nothing and makes them something by his power, not by their wisdom and their power, even though we may well take credit for ourselves. But God says, "I do it of my own glory." He says, "When I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him?" Isn't it incredible that God even knows we are here, even though he created us, that he takes the care and the time to focus to have a relationship with us at all? David was just writing his expression. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the work of your hands and put all things under his feet, sheep and oxen, beasts of the field, birds of the air, fish of the sea that pass through the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. When you reflect on the majesty of God, you can't help but be a little bit reduced in your own mind. Psalm 144 carries on again. David still here, reflecting similarly. Blessed be the rock, the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle. David giving God the credit for the strength and the skill that he had been given. My loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower, my deliverer, my shield, and the one in whom I take refuge, who subdues my people under me. Lord, what is man that you take knowledge of him, or the son of man that you're mindful of him? Man is like a breath. As I drove down to Kennewick this morning, I found the first fog that I've traveled in this season, scattered along the roadside, and the climate now is changing, and there'll be time shortly where we walk outdoors and our breath will crystallize in the air and momentarily be there and then pass away and never to be seen again. David likens man here to like a breath, something that is very momentary and passing and it is gone. And yet, from our perspective, sometimes we strive so mightily to accomplish and succeed and to be recognized or to be something in our own eyes. Man is like a breath. His days are like a passing shadow. Bow down your heavens, O Lord, and come down. Touch the mountains, and they shall smoke. Flash forth lightning, scatter them, shoot out your arrows, and destroy them. David is saying, you have the power, and we have nothing. And brethren, as long as we keep that in our focus, it will be of good benefit to us. Compared to the rest of creation, our life is just like a little fleck of dust thrown up in the air and cast away, never to be seen again. Compared to God, we are so insignificant, it's amazing that we even exist. You know, they've estimated, and with the Hubble telescope now, they've looked out further and further into space. They took recently one of the darkest spots they could find, the blackest hole they could look at in space, where nothing appeared to be, and they focused the telescope there for a long exposure, and they let it slowly feed the lenses in the cameras there to see what was there, and when they developed that out, it was absolutely filled with distant galaxies. Just filled the lens, everything across the scale. It was unbelievable. They estimate now that there's maybe as many as 100 billion galaxies out there. You could take every person who's ever lived on the face of the earth and you could give them a galaxy and say, well, this one's for you and we got a few for spare parts. Let me know what you need. You know, we'll send you over a comet. Well, you know, anything you want, we can salvage what remains. And I've heard, too, some estimates that in the galaxies, each one, there could be like 100 billion stars. Now, God made all of that, and then he made us, and we're on this little insignificant place, and we go out, and we build, and we create, and we produce, and we are so sometimes pleased with what we have done, and it is nothing. It's like dust. It's like breath. It's like a passing shadow compared to what God has produced and to how he exists. Now, what does that have to do with today? Our sojourning, our passage on this life. Isn't the Feast of Tabernacles the time when we stay in temporary dwellings? We go to motels or wherever it is that we get a chance to stay. Even this is a temporary dwelling. We're here for a day only. Didn't the Israelites even hang up branches and make booths and temporary dwellings so that they could observe the Feast of Tabernacles? When I was in college in Big Sandy, we stayed in Booth City. There were supposed to be temporary little houses that were only there for a time. Well, they were there for about as long as anything else was. Not very temporary, but that's the intent when they started. When Michelle and I lived in Pasadena and the feast was held there, we actually vacated our home, gave it to someone else so that we could go stay somewhere temporary and in our minds fulfill the intent of the feast. We didn't have to do that. It's simply something we chose to do. So now tell me, who's going to be living in temporary dwellings during the millennium? You and me? I certainly hope not. I certainly hope that I am not in a temporary dwelling during the millennium. I don't plan to still be in the flesh then. I don't plan to be dependent on the harvest or on a paycheck or on needing shelter over my head. When Christ returns, my sojourn is over. God willing, I'll be a spirit being, never to be dependent on physical sustenance again. And that's part of the significance of the Feast of Trumpets, brethren. No more temporary dwellings for you and me forever. No more transitions, no more sojourning, no more pilgrimages for you and me forever. In Hebrews 11, we have the example of those who were faithful, that were recorded here by God, to encourage us and show us that they had a temporary existence as well. In fact, more temporary than you and I probably have ever had to be. Hebrews 11, verse number 7, by faith Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. He literally left everything behind and went on, started absolutely from scratch. At least I got to move into a house somebody else had already built. All I had to do was find a tree or a bush or a plant, help Michelle and work with her and put that place in whatever condition we could to make it nice for us. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place that he would afterward receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. Sometimes I don't know where I'm going, but this is a reference to... He really didn't know where God was leading him and what his intention ultimately was in terms of where he would be. And he just simply went. He sojourned in his life. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country, a stranger, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And so he looked for stability, and he desired foundation. And God showed him that he could have that, but he would have to wait, and he never got to have it in this life. Verse 13, these all died in faith, because it gives examples of various people here, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were assured of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland, a place where they can put down their roots, but a place indeed that God would choose in his time. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better. In other words, if they looked back and wanted bad enough to go back where they were, God would have let him. Abraham could have said, I've had it, I want to go home. And he could have walked out the door and gone back. We could walk out the door today, each one of us, and go back to whatever it is that we wanted the most. And God wouldn't necessarily stop us. But that's not what we've been called to do. Now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, because he has prepared a city for them. Verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Moses left behind stability, continuity, honor, and riches to wander around in the desert with a tent, and Moses never did get to see the promised land in the sense of putting down his roots and establishing himself there. He lived his whole life in a period of transition. Says, by faith, verse 29, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. Those who kept their roots died. Those who gave up all that they had to give lived, because God was leading them. Verse 38 makes a comment of, again, these and more, of whom the world was not worthy. Now the world values stability and accomplishment and production and overcoming in the sense of producing and having more than others and being recognized for it. That is a very high value. And it says of these who gave up what they had, of the whom the world was not worthy. And they wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. They never got those roots established in that life, in the sense of being where God had called them to come, because that promise still remains far off. They all died, so their sojourn is over, right? They died and their sojourn is over. No, not at all. Even sojourning in the grave is but a moment in time. Death is a sojourn as well. God, having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us, they now wait for us to be ready as well. They and our sojourn will not be over until Christ returns. What is it, or maybe one of the things, that has become so tragically common in the world today? What is it that we have in common in the Middle East, in Central and Northern Africa, in Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe and elsewhere, as a result of wars, political posturing, decision, drought, famine? What is happening in all of those parts of the world that is in common? All of those areas have refugees in many of them. People forced from their homes, cast out by one another. I remember hearing of the story of some of the Kurds as they left out of Iraq and headed toward the mountains, being forced out of the area where they lived, and it talked about how they started out with all these possessions and trying to pull carts and move along, and bit by bit, just like in the wagon trains and trails of the West, the pieces had to be set aside, and you got down to what it was that you valued the most, what it was that would help you survive to get to where you were going. Refugees all over the world have had to make those desperate and terrible choices. And they're not just from somewhere other than here in the United States. We have refugees from Mexico and South America flood across our border every single day. They are refugees just like the rest in various ways. Now, my parents were born here in the United States. And their parents were born here in the United States. And at least on my dad's side, though his grandparents were refugees. Now, they didn't call them refugees, they called them immigrants. But they were refugees just the same. They came here because it wasn't working back home. Those that were in Ireland came because they were starving back home. Others came to have freedom, but it wasn't working for them back home. And they came here looking for something better, something more. And they found it, frankly, but it still wasn't a true refuge. They may have found refuge from hunger and thirst, but they didn't find it from injury and pain. They didn't have refuge from corruption and deceit. Listening to the radio as I was driving down to Kennewick this morning actually depressed me. Actually depressed me. I'd turn it off. God the Father gave us His name. Everyone who is called by My name, whom I have created for My glory, I formed him, yes, I made him. God says, I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring your descendants back. I'm going to put them in one place. And there won't be a temporary placement anymore. Isaiah 54 has a similar passage that is encouraging to me as well. Do not fear, for you will not be ashamed, nor be disgraced, for you will not be put to shame, for you will forget the shame of your youth. And you will not remember the reproach of your widowhood any more. For your Maker is your husband, the Lord of hosts is His name. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. God says, I'm going to take those of you who are cast out, set aside, who have been left behind and thrown away by someone or by this society or by this world. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He is called the God of the whole earth. For the Lord has called you like a woman forsaken and grieving in spirit, like a youthful wife when you were refused. God's going to say, I will take you now, says your God. For a mere moment I have forsaken you, like that shadow that passes under the tree. By comparison to God's plan, it's but a moment in time. With great mercies I will gather you. With a little wrath I hid my face from you for a moment. But with everlasting kindness I will have mercy on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. For this is like the waters of Noah to me, where God had power and control and protected Noah in the ark and fulfilled his plan. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah would no longer cover the earth, so I have sworn that I would not be angry with you nor rebuke you. For the mountains will depart, the hills will be removed, and my kindness will not depart from you, nor my covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord, who has mercy on you. God's people will be restored. The church of God someday will come back together. It has to. If indeed we are God's people, we will be one with God. And we will in some way ultimately be one with each other as well. We must. I sent a memo to a friend of mine this last week who is in another church of God, and I just said, you know, someday there will be a great crisis, and it will be sufficient that maybe you and I will choose to take refuge in the same foxhole once again. But I says it will take a great crisis to do that, so we can set aside all of the other things that divide us, because on many, many things we do obviously still agree. And I said, you know, it might even be in spite of, and probably will be in spite of, some of those leaders who would separate us. And so I just said, I hope someday, I expect someday under crisis, we will take refuge in that same foxhole once again. And I believe we will do so. God is going to restore his people to him. Last night, after I finished working on my sermon, I was tired, took out my brain, set it on the desk, decided to relax a little bit, and I've been trying over the last weeks to go out and look at those stars, remember who God is, try to keep focus on what I'm not. And at night sometimes when everything is finished and the house is quiet and the lights are out and everybody's asleep, and I'll go down too and I'll look at my bookcase, and just for a few minutes I'll try to find something I can finish on to set my mind and focus and give me something so that I go to bed and I rest and I sleep and I wake up and I'm ready to go again. And I've been trying to find ways to be strengthened and to be encouraged and to be focused better and more in place where I need and should be. So last night I kind of laid down on the floor next to my bookcase. And I was just going down to the bottom shelf. I never look on the bottom because you have to bend over. And I'm looking on the bottom. Here's a little blue sliver of a book. I pulled the book out and I looked at it. I've never really read this book before. I know I had it, but I've never really taken the time to focus on it. And it was a book of letters that one of my uncles wrote back in World War II before he died. It was the brother of my mother who died when I was a child. And her family at some point had a reunion and gathered letters up from different members of the family, put them in this book, bound it, passed it out, and I got a copy somewhere, and I said, fine, stuffed it on the shelf. I mean, I didn't know these people. I didn't know who even the names were back then. And so I pulled this out and I began to look through it, reading these letters from a pilot, from someone who was related to me, but again, whom I really don't know. And in there was letters to Tootie. And I said, well, that's interesting. 2 years ago, I made contact with Tootie. Tootie was my mother's youngest sister. And she babysat me when I was a baby and watched me those early years when I grew up until we separated as families and all went our own way. And so I have no conscious memory of her whatsoever, but through letters and knowing where she was in San Antonio, we were in Lubbock. And so I made contact with her and called down, and I went down, and my son Brad was over visiting us there, so Brad and I went down to see her. And this was a remarkable thing. Here is your aunt, who you do not consciously remember having ever seen in this life, and she knows who you are. And you sat on her lap, and she held you, and it was the most exciting thing you can imagine in that kind of a way. And we sat there, spent the night, talked and talked and talked and talked, and tried to catch up on all those things. And they're both retired, and they love to fish, and they have a boat, and so they go out in the Gulf and they fish, and they're telling me all these expeditions of fishing and show me the pictures and all that they do. And I said, well, I'll just come down from time to time. We'll go fishing on the Gulf. We'll sit out there all night under the lantern, and we'll have a good time, and we'll get to know each other, and this will be a real blessing and opportunity. And so she was excited that we had come down and made contact. And then we were transferred. And we were gone. I mean, we were gone overnight, and it was, she couldn't believe it. And she sent me a note. We made contact on email, but she sent me a note. She said, you know, all these years and I wondered about you, and all these years and I wanted to have a relationship, and I had you there, and now you're gone. And she just couldn't believe it. A couple of months, and we never made the second trip even back. And now she's in San Antonio, and we're up here. Well, I tell you, you think life's not transitory and temporary and momentary. All you have to do is think through your life and be reminded of it very, very quickly. What we do and the opportunities we have, no matter how complicated and even sometimes painful they are to us, they are just a moment, a flash, a shadow. They are no more than breath in the air compared to God's purpose for us and His plans. No more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain. That's what the Feast of Trumpets portrays to us, to you and to me. No more getting up and walking away. No more leaving before something is finished or fulfilled. No more leaving something undone. When you and I will be gathered to Jesus Christ at His return, then our sojourning in this flesh will end, and that will be an incredible and wonderful and great day. 2 years ago, on the Day of Trumpets, Megan kept a little journal, and she wrote down during that day what the Day of Trumpets was about. And just again, this was just a journal that she kept, and drew pictures of angels up in the air with wings and everything on it. And I copied it out of her little journal. It says, Saturday. It is the Feast of Trumpets. I love the Feast of Trumpets. The Feast of Trumpets means when you hear a trumpet, God is coming from the sky. It means God is coming and you will be happy with God. Pretty simple description. Could have saved a lot of time in hall rental if I just explained it like it was. Feast of Trumpets is the time when our sojourning will end and we will be with God forever. What a great day that is truly going to be.